Penguin Random House Canada presents The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields. Read for you by Deborah Drakeford. For my sister, Babs. A number of people have read the manuscript for this book and offered encouragement and suggestions. I thank Blanche Howard, Joan Clark, Jim Keller, Anne Giardini, Catherine, Meg, and Sarah Shields, and especially Miss Louise Wyatt of London, Ontario. Nothing she did or said was quite what she meant, but still her life could be called a monument, shaped in a slant of available light and set to the movement of possible music. From The Grandmother Cycle by Judith Downing, Converse Quarterly, Autumn. Foreword by the author. I have never written with such happiness as during the 2-year period when I was working on The Stone Diaries. The book seemed to be about something that mattered, though I didn't know what it was. And it went along willingly enough once I'd discovered a framework, which was the borrowed design of an old-fashioned 19th-century biography with its title sequences of birth, childhood, love, and onward to death. When I first began the novel, I thought I was writing a family saga, or rather, a subversion of the family saga as we know it. Before long, I realized I was, instead, writing about the subject of autobiography, about the central question of whether or not we can know the story of our own lives. How much of our existence is actually recorded? How much invented? How much imagined? How much revised or erased? The most substantial parts of a human narrative, it seemed to me, were borrowed from the impressions that other people, friends and family and passing acquaintances, had of us. And I wanted these imagined voices to enter the novel and to inform Daisy Goodwill Flett, born in rural Manitoba in 1905. What do people think of us? These received thoughts, sometimes tragically, make a life. Daisy survives into her 90s, and her life corresponds, more or less, with the span of the century, posing the question of where these last 100 years have delivered women, especially those women who failed to make the public record. My plan was to cut into Daisy's life every 10 years or so, just to see what she was doing. I realized that my writer's scalpel, with its autocratic and methodical slicing, would miss some major moments: Daisy's sexual initiation, her education, her childbirths. But such arbitrariness might gather into its grasp something other. Perhaps those less exclamatory and genuinely revealing events. Each day as I sat down to write, I conjured up an image of a series of nesting boxes. I was making the outside box. Daisy was making the inside box. And inside her box was nothing. She was thinking, not writing, her own life story. But it was a life from which she, the subject, had been subtracted. This was the truth, I felt at that time, of most women's lives. Musing about autobiography made me think about the photographs that always accompany such books. I asked my publisher, Christopher Potter, if we could have a clutch of such photos in the middle of the book. I explained that I wanted, somehow, to gesture toward another form. I expected him to say no, that photos would be too expensive, and, furthermore, one didn't offer photographs with a novel. But he said yes, we can do that. Immediately, I thought about what else I might ask for. What about a family tree? Yes, he said, we can do that too. And an epigraph from the family archives? Yes. His handful of permissions kept me steady as I finished the book. Writers, famously, resist talking about their work in progress. But I talked and talked about this book to everyone. I asked my friend, Jennifer Graham, about her elderly father, Alf. And she told me where she suspected his thoughts drifted to and what they were made of. I asked my colleagues at the University of Manitoba, over lunch, meeting in the hallways of the arts building, about certain period phrases I wanted to use. Professor Lou Lehman managed to track down the expression, "see you in the movies," to a novel published in 1929. That was good news. I could use it. The Stone Diaries only seems like a private book, almost, in fact, a woman's intimate journal. I am astonished, looking back, how public the writing of it was. I loved this collective assemblage, this gathering of verbal cues and scattered anecdotes. This process was a large part of the joy I felt at that time. I did believe, as I wrote the final chapter, that I had written a sad book. From its inception, I found myself writing toward the phrase, "I am not at peace." When I got there, finally, on the second to last page, I was reluctant to register those words. My want had always been to find harmony and reconciliation, but the phrase pressed on my consciousness and my conscience. Finally, I committed it to print. I've learned to live with that hard choice. Carol Shields, December 2001. 1. Birth, 1905. My mother's name was Mercy Stone Goodwill. She was only 30 years old when she took sick, a boiling hot day, standing there in her back kitchen making a Malvern pudding for her husband's supper. A cookery book lay open on the table. "Take some slices of stale bread," the recipe said, "and 1 pint of currants, 1/2 pint of raspberries, 4 ounces of sugar, some sweet cream if available." Of course, she's divided the recipe in half, there being just the two of them. And what with the scarcity of currants and Kyler, my father, being a dainty eater. A pick and nibble fellow, she calls him, able to take his food or leave it. It shames her how little the man eats, diddling his spoon around in his dish, perhaps raising his eyes once or twice to send her one of his shy, appreciative glances across the table, but never taking a second helping, just leaving it all for her to finish up, pulling his hand through the air with that dreamy gesture of his that urges her on, and smiling all the while, his daft, tender-faced look. What did food mean to a working man like himself? A bother, a distraction, perhaps even a kind of price that had to be paid in order to remain upright and breathing. Well, it was a different story for her, for my mother. Eating was as close to heaven as my mother ever came. In our day, we have a name for a passion as disordered as hers. And almost as heavenly as eating was the making. How she gloried in it. Every last body on this earth has a particular notion of paradise, and this was hers. Standing in the murderously hot back kitchen of her own house, concocting and contriving, leaning forward and squinting at the fine print of the cookery book, a clean wooden spoon in hand. It's something to see, the way she concentrates, her hot, busy face, the way she thrills to see the dish take form as she pours the stewed fruit into the fancy mold, pressing the thickly cut bread down over the oozing...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?